Back at it, new week, new show on Monday, June 8th on Connecticut Today. Chris Moscovides joined us in the 2 o'clock hour. Chris, one of our cyber experts, he called in to talk about new reports that maybe nations hostile to the U.S. like China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, maybe they're cranking up their cyber efforts against the U.S. during our current social unrest. 3 o'clock hour, we talked to a professor from Quinnipiac University about what's going on with a couple of major newspapers and some controversy they've been involved with. We're talking about the Philadelphia Inquirer and the New York Times. State Rep. Steve Stafstrom joined us in the 5 o'clock hour to talk about what the General Assembly might do to move along police reform in the state. Our own Melissa Sheketoff from Melissa in the Morning joined us after 5:30. She was at a Milford protest against racism and police brutality. And also, we took some portions of Governor Ned Lamont's daily coronavirus update. And especially now, we're taking a look at that because of everything that's going on with the elections and voting and misinformation, and now word of all this obviously really bad unrest going on with the George Floyd situation. Chris Moscovides is the guest. He joins us again on the program. Chris and Ann Murray are a wife-husband-CEO combination of the New York City-based TMG-E Media. Chris, Paul here on WYCC again. Good to talk to you. How are you?
Good to talk to you as well. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good, Chris. Well, you see this from afar now, from a distance. What are your thoughts as to what you've been seeing, what you're hearing in your business circles, maybe amongst folks like you to do this for a living? Update us a little bit. What have you seen so far?
Well, we continue to see increased attacks because of the vulnerabilities that have been created by the coronavirus. So a lot of organized crime, organized hackers are taking advantage of this, and they are attacking health clinics, they're attacking hospitals, and also they are really expanding their personal identity information hacking and, you know, basically going after people's money and identities. So that's ongoing and increasing due to the pandemic. We have very serious considerations about what's going to happen with the upcoming election because the coronavirus exacerbates the security situation with elections. And we're talking about mail-in ballots. We're talking about security systems. For that matter, this morning, DARPA, which is the defense agency that has all of these famous projects, is asking hackers to try to crack its new generation of super secure hardware. Hopefully, when that's done and we have proven them secure, they will be able to deploy it and we can at least breathe a little easier when it comes into elections technology. But overall, the sentiment among people that I speak to is fairly gloomy. We see very dark clouds in the horizons, and people are expecting, the big cyber attack to happen within the next 6 months.
Really? And this is coming from where, Chris? The usual actors? Iran, Iraq, Russia, China? What are you thinking here? North Korea? Tell us about that.
Well, there is speculation that nation states are going to really unleash cyber warfare against the United States, kick them while they're down. And so there's certainly the nation state angle on this, but there is also certainly the forever increasing organized crime action against individuals and institutions in the United States.
Wow. Chris, I heard a report last week, and I'm sure you've seen this, that and the feds actually came out, I think, and said this, which is how bad it was, that the Biden campaign, I believe, was being targeted by China, and they had information or thoughts that Iran was targeting the Trump campaign. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, you've read correctly. So certainly, Trump and his administration are no friends of Iran, and Iran has a fairly sophisticated cyber warfare capacity, and they would be going after him. So that makes perfect sense. I don't know why China has motives against Biden, but nothing surprises me at this point in the game. The worry that we have right now. It's not so much, well, of course it is the hacking. I didn't mean to say that it's not so much the hacking. Of course, it's always the straight up hacking and disinformation. But there is capacity right now to create deep fakes. There is capacity of disinformation that is far more damaging than an actual breach, right? So if I breach Biden's campaign and I'm stealing his emails, that's one thing. I can potentially get some valuable information about that. I can potentially release damaging information that's circulating on the emails. But if I am a foreign nation and I'm hacking Biden, what I am interested is in finding out what his strategies are and what his position is going to be against me or for me. That's at the core. But if I am a political opponent of Biden's, what I am interested in doing is destroying this guy. So how are you going to destroy this guy? You are going to propagate disinformation and create fake documents and fake information and flood the internet with that, having the candidate and his campaign go chasing after and trying to quell all of this misinformation. We can generate videos right now, deep fake videos, that once circulated, sure, there is computer science departments and experts that can debunk them and say, no, the video that you have Biden over there saying that he'll take everybody's guns and turn the country into, you know, a communist society is absolutely fake. But that's going to be coming out of an academic institution and real experts that can say, yeah, this is a deep fake video. We have identified it. It's debunked. But you can imagine how this plays, though, in the hands of political operatives, right? They're like, I don't know about this being a fake. I think they're calling it a fake. So it's going to, you know, so now you're trying to, you know, prove a negative.
Chris, hang on. Chris Moscovides is the guest. Chris, we'll be right back with you. I want to get more into this. This is always fascinating stuff from this gentleman when we have him on. More with Chris straight ahead. Traffic, weather together, 236 on WICC. Few more minutes with a return guest, Chris Moscovides. He is half of a husband-wife team. He and his wife, Ann Murray, run the New York City-based TMGE Media. You've seen him quoted in several media outlets, and this is the stuff they live and eat and breathe all day, folks. So we're trying to get him on here and give you a little heads up here. Chris, you mentioned earlier about, you know, cyber attacks and nation states doing this. How would that affect, beyond the politics here, Chris, but Joe and Mary's six-pack out there listening to me right now, who maybe, you know, use the computer a little bit, you know, or maybe a smartphone, emailing their kids or, you know, trying to get information on a recipe or something, maybe some banking too. How would that affect the average person if a nation state did that, Chris?
Well, there is two ways to look at this. At the individual level, you're being affected by organized hackers where they're going to steal your identity and therefore can also steal your money and can make your life misery. So that's the direct touch, right? That's somebody actually physically coming out and stealing from you or your family. And the particular risk are the two extremes of the demographics, right? So the young children are at extreme risk, and so are the elderly. Young children are at risk because if I can steal the social security numbers of young children, I can create credit profiles for young people that actually they don't have a credit history, and I can harvest that. Yeah. Elderly people fall for the scams of like, hey, your son is in the hospital, wire me $3,000 for the doctor, that kind of stuff. Nation states are in a power game. They're always in a power game. It's always about dominance and power. So when Putin is after our elections, he is doing us so that he can, you know, cut us down a couple of notches and prove to the world that democracy is not where it's at, that America is not where it's at, and people should be listening to him and his way of doing business. So it creates status, it creates power. Same thing with China. Same thing with all of these major powers. They are showing the world that they are the major player, not America. So if I can interfere with your elections and then you are in shambles, I'm sitting in the back laughing and I'm telling to my people, look at them. Is this the great power? Look at them. They're ridiculous. We at least know what it is that we're doing. And that there is, so there is internal benefit to that, but there's also world benefit to the world stage. Because if they go around to the world saying, who are you going to talk to? I mean, who? That America? America can't even hold an election right. You're going to talk to me about America? You talk to me. Because I have the gas, I have the power, I have the intellect, I have the money. So they are changing the power dynamics of the planet by using cyber warfare. You know, for that matter, right now China is investing, I don't remember the exact number of billions, and they are in the hundreds of billions of dollars in artificial intelligence research. Why are they doing this? They are doing this so that they can be the number one player in what's promising to be the greatest disruptor in human history. They're not doing it because all of a sudden China has developed, you know, deep academic interest in computer science. They're doing it because they know that this is going to make them the number one power on the planet.
I had Chris, another computer expert or two, on who said the same thing. And one thing was interesting. We were talking about the manipulation, Chris, of people who talk or argue, whether it's serious or it's in fun, about politics. And they both said what you said regarding foreign actors. But one of them said that I guess some of this artificial intelligence, Chris, is so good now that it can pose as a person, correct, on a discussion board and actually in real time, I don't know, Chris, kind of react to what's being said to the point where you really think you're arguing with a real person, correct?
Absolutely. That is absolutely the case. There is a lot of automated bots that can infiltrate social networks, and they can post things, and they can absolutely create havoc. Remember, the narrower the field, the easier it is to deploy an artificial intelligence against it. So, for example, if I am, for that matter, we have actually done that many, many, many years ago. Our company was the first to create, you know, quote unquote, an artificial intelligence bot.
Wow.
That provided you with recipes. It would ask you, so how are you feeling today? You say, well, I'm feeling kind of blue. And then you will say, well, if you're feeling kind of blue, I have the perfect pasta recipe for you. Now, obviously, that's not artificial intelligence. But now take this and scroll forward 30 years, which is where we are right now.
Yeah.
If I am on a political board, I have a very limited, if you will, segment of information that I can propagate, and I can respond to it with pre-canned answers. I'm not talking about general artificial intelligence where I'm holding a conversation on 10,000 different topics.
Yeah.
I'm talking about Democrats versus Republicans, for example.
Yeah.
So, yes, these tools exist. They are extraordinarily dangerous because they can be deployed in the thousands, and that's the point. You flood the boards with opinions that suit your purpose and spread chaos and disinformation.
And Chris, final question then. If you know this and all the experts in your field know this and the federal government knows this and a bunch of people know this, do they do a good enough job, Chris, at telling people this, at saying, hey, you may be arguing with a computer here, back off? Is that not explained well enough to people?
So here is the danger of where we live. You just hit the nail on the head, okay? Because you're talking about federal government, to which my question back to you is like, which federal government exactly? Because there is certainly a tier of the federal government staffed by dedicated civil servants and by dedicated experts that have been raising the alarms on issues like this. And it's not just cybersecurity. It's not just AI. It's the environment and medicine and pandemics and everything. So there is this layer of the federal government that has been like shouting and screaming and raising red flags left, right, and center. And there are other layers of the federal government and the state government and local governments that the only thing they care about is the power that they hold at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So if it is convenient for me to turn around and say science is fake, don't believe this, then, and I'm a person of authority, then all of a sudden if I change my tune and start telling you, well, watch out, because God forbid the Russians are telling you baloney and you're buying it. And you're going to turn around and say, well, wait a minute. Yesterday you were saying that all of the stuff is fake. Now you're telling me it's not fake, so which is it? So we are shooting ourselves in the foot. We are damaging our own credibility of our own scientists and our own experts. And that is a very dangerous thing.
Chris Moscovides. Chris, as always, great stuff. He's a team with his wife, Ann P. Murray. It's a New York-based firm, TMG-eMedia. Chris, what is your website, contact information, if somebody wants to contact you or your company?
They can find us at the easiest website is tmgr.com, TomMaryGeorgeRobert.com. Go there, and from there you can navigate and find us easily.
Chris, thank you. We appreciate it. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you down the line toward the election. Chris, thank you.
Thank you. Look forward to it. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Chris Moscovides. But I'm a trained journalist. I have a journalism degree from a really good journalism school, learned from some great people, have done newspaper reporting, radio news over the years. And when I see what's happening in some areas, it kind of makes me worried a little bit as a reflection of what might be going on. Joining us right now to talk about that is a Quinnipiac University journalism professor, Ben Borgardis. Ben, how are you? Paul here again. How you been?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Ben, over the weekend, we saw a couple of things, actually the last couple, 2 or 3 days, at two really marquee papers in the country. Of course, the New York Times, which, love it or hate it, Ben, I have people who read it from cover to cover every day and people who line their cat box with it. I mean, there's, you know, the Times is very polarizing, but it is, I guess, Ben, by default, the nation's flagship newspaper. And the Philadelphia Inquirer, you had scenarios here where because they ran, pieces that may have been a little provocative, which sometimes editorials are, people are no longer working there. A major editor at the Inquirer is out. One of the editorial page people at the Times is out. What do you make of all this? Where are we going with this?
I think where we're going is that the newspapers are trying to balance the needs of their employees and the needs of their readers. You know, in the sense of employees, you mentioned this, the New York Times, that came out of a editorial written by Senator Tom Cotton that some employees in the newsroom thought put them in danger. He called for the United States military to help put down some of the nighttime riots and more violent protests. And some of the reporters said that that would put them in danger if they were on the ground. In Pittsburgh, you know, they ran a headline which was seen as sort of insensitive. So many of the reporters there thought that the newspaper was sort of actively attacking their reporting by that. And then thinking about the readers, you know, if the readers see this, if the readers don't trust the newspaper to accurately report what's going on, if the readers don't think that the newspaper is being sort of sensitive to the national mood, then readers might turn away. So they're sort of in a tough spot. They're sort of balancing protecting their own people and sort of enlightening the public while at the same time making sure that the public gets the correct information.
You know, I don't know whether you saw, Ben, Barry Weiss, who was one of, I guess, the editorial page editors, or she works on the editorial page. She posted some tweets and made some quotes that were interesting, and she illustrated something that I was actually congratulating her to myself, you know, of being refreshingly frank about this. She said it's an age thing, and she went on to say, I don't know whether you saw the exact quote, she goes, generally our older staffers, maybe those who are in their 40s and above, are like, listen, this stuff is ugly, but we're a newspaper and this is what we do. And a lot of the, what she put, the quote-unquote, you know, the woke, the younger staffers, 40, 35 and below, seem to cringe at this. Is this, I guess this is a societal thing as well, Ben.
Absolutely. And you know, the New York Times, all the news that's put to print, I think she mentioned that, you know, it comes down to, is it all the news or is it all the news that's fit to print? So there are some, she mentioned the younger reporters who may have grown up in a different era who, you know, think that the newspapers have a responsibility to portray events that are important and thoughts that are important. And the Tom Cotton opinion piece, you know, they said wasn't vetted enough. It had some parts in it that, aside from being, you know, allegedly dangerous to the reporters, weren't supported by the reporting the Times was doing. So they said it should have been, you know, vetted more carefully, among other things. So it comes down to the idea of, you know, what is the role of the newspaper? Is it to put all the information out there and let people decide? Or is it to filter the information and tell people the, you know, correct version of things factually, not necessarily the correct version of way to think, but make sure that anything that does appear in the paper can be backed up by that paper's reporting.
Ben, hang on. I want to dovetail off that because an immediate question came to me. First, we'll do traffic and weather together. Ben Borgardis, a communications professor at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, back with more from Ben straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together, 3:36 on WICC. It's here with Professor Ben Borgardis from Quinnipiac University, journalism professor there. You know, Ben, something you said very interesting before we took the break, the fact that ultimately the idea is, you know, to get the truth, to get a balanced representation of these issues. And maybe it goes for TV, too, and I think radio as well, you know, news radio and things like that. And I think you're correct. And I think if these outlets, Ben, don't take a few chances and maybe do things that may be unpopular but unveil some of the truth, that kind of feeds into the problem, don't you think, of then people then seeking out a website that's, you know, whether it's on the far left or the far right or a far left paper or a far right paper, that okay, see, this confirms what I thought. It's that whole confirmation bias thing.
Absolutely, and that's part of the sort of modern era of social media where people are in a bubble. They seek out news which confirms their own previously held beliefs. So the New York Times, you mentioned earlier, being a very liberal paper, it's a paper that's, you know, based in the largest city in the country, and it definitely has, especially on the editorial pages, a viewpoint that skews left. When I put in a editorial opinion piece by a conservative Republican senator from the South, I mean, that's not going to be popular with a lot of their readers to begin with. And then the issue that he's talking about, also controversial. So, but that's sort of the point. You know, they have the editorials, which are the opinions of the paper written by a separate group from the newsroom. There's always a separation between the editorial side and the newspaper side. But they have the op-eds, which go on the other side, which are written by outside contributors. So when someone has a different opinion from the paper, they invite those opinions in. But where we came to the problem here was that it was an unpopular opinion that some people thought wasn't worthy of publication.
And, Ben, I think that's kind of sometimes, Ben, I hate to use the word lazy, but sometimes there is lazy thinking by people. You know, you could read, there are newspapers that I read for news, Ben, but I tend to not pay attention to the editorial page. I don't like the people that write there, or some I very much like. I think, Ben, we've had this, I don't know, this diminution, this blurring of people being able to understand that there is the hard news reporting of, you know, the newspapers or of the cable networks, and then there's the opinion shows. I wonder why people have such a problem discerning that. Any thoughts on that?
I think I mentioned earlier social media. It's so easy to share an article, share a headline, see it on a Twitter feed, see it on a Facebook feed, and people see the New York Times mentioned there. You know, they don't really make the distinction between this is a New York Times opinion piece, New York Times editorial, and this is a New York Times news piece. It's the same name. When you only have a limited number of characters or limited number of headline words in a blurb, sometimes that gets lost. And when people only look at the headlines, they don't read the articles, they really don't get that sense of what's a news article and what's a news headline.
We know that the idea of newspapers editorializing, Ben, goes back, you know, almost to the beginning of the country, probably. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, they want to influence people. You know, when we had the mass immigration here, a lot of folks coming here didn't understand our politics. So the papers, for whatever reason, would say vote for this person or vote for that person. Don't vote for this or vote for that. Do you think people really care about what the opinion of a newspaper is anymore or not?
That's an interesting question. I think that they don't. They assume, based on where the newspaper is and what they see coming out of that newspaper over time. I think that people, you know, go into it a little more skeptically, thinking when they see the New York Times. You don't necessarily realize that there is a hard and fast separation between the people who write the editorials, the opinion pieces on one side of the newsroom, and the news writers who actually report and gather factual, unbiased stories on the other. And in most newsrooms, there is a very strict separation between the two because they don't want to make it seem like the news coverage is being influenced by the editorial pages in the back of the front section of the paper.
Ben, final question. I don't know whether you saw it, but I guess a couple of weeks ago in the midst of all this, I think, forgive me if I'm wrong, but I think it was the Providence Journal Bulletin, the Projo out there, that came out and said, we as a newspaper, I guess they'll still have guest columnists, but they themselves are not going to do editorials anymore. I'm wondering, Ben, when I read this, I said to myself, I'm wondering if this may be a product of, hey, are we ticking off too many people? Did you see that? What did you think of that?
I did, actually, yes. And it comes down to the old USA Today model. When USA Today started becoming popular in the 80s, they started by saying, we are not going to run our own editorials. We're not going to tell you what we as a newspaper think, our editorial board thinks. We're going to have people, guest columnists, write for us, and we're going to clearly label these. This is an opinion of an outside person. Mm-hmm. So I think what the Providence paper is doing is saying, you know, we are in a very polarized moment in American history. You have people who feel very strongly on both sides of the political issues, and we as a newspaper don't want to even sort of give the thought that from someone reading this that we are biased in one way or the other. We want to be a trusted news source. We want to be a news source that people go to and they can be assured that the story they're reading is unbiased. And it sends a mixed signal when one side of the paper is, you know, saying one thing, advocating for one thing, and then a news article is maybe saying another thing. So I think that it's actually a very smart decision given the current sort of polarized era where, you know, people are looking for news sources that are unbiased, and they're taking a big stand to try to show off the fact that, you know, they're voluntarily giving up something they've done for decades because they think it's the right time to make sure that people know what they're reading is unbiased.
Ben, thank you. As always, great to have you. Associate Professor of Journalism at Quinnipiac, Professor Ben Bogardus. Ben, thank you. We'll be in touch. Stay safe.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it. All right, little perspective there, folks. You may have been and again, you know, the New York Times, yes, I know we have the Connecticut Post and we have the Stanford Advocate, we have the Norwalk Hour, we have all the Hearst papers, we have, you know, Darien Times and all that. You know, we have all the papers that are with us here in Fairfield County, but especially in Fairfield County, if there's going to be what the publishing business calls, you know, a supplemental buy, in other words, that second paper, it's the New York Times for Connecticut and much of Fairfield County. So thanks to Ben Bogardus, Associate Professor of Journalism in the Comm School at Quinnipiac, as the New York Times got into a real row. Yeah, a lot of you folks obviously were aware of that if you read the Times in Lower Fairfield County about allowing Tom Cotton, the senator from Arkansas, to essentially argue the president's point that maybe you do use the military. And Cotton himself is a military veteran, so he's not some chicken hawk who's never served. He's done on the local level, on the national level, and at the state level as well. And speaking of the state level, we welcome back to the program here State Rep. Democrat Steve Staffstrom from Bridgeport. Steve, Paul here again. How are you, sir?
Can you hear me now?
Oh, I can. Can you hear me now? Yeah, beautiful. You should do a commercial, Steve. It's good.
All right.
Okay, so first of all, we heard the governor earlier today in his COVID-19 news conference, as he has alluded to, Steve, over the past week or so, saying, you know, we're going to do something. There are things we're going to do here. As a member of the General Assembly, what can be done? What are you guys and gals in both parties looking at, Steve, on a state level here to try and at least get the ball rolling on more safeguards?
So, Paul, let me start by saying this is not an issue that Connecticut is new to. It's not like we just started looking at changes to statutes and reforming and talking about the issue of police accountability and transparency after George Floyd's tragic death. This is an issue Connecticut has actually been working on and leading on for a number of years, and I think we as a state should be proud of that. We have a fairly robust body camera program in the state where municipalities can apply for and get reimbursement to purchase body cameras. We've updated our hate crime laws in the state within the last couple of years. And then most recently, last legislative session, we passed Senate Bill 380, which made a number of police accountability and transparency reforms, including when body camera footage would be released after an incident, what an incident report would be generated and produced, tightened up when the use of force is justified, and also impaneled a task force, which has been meeting to continue to talk and look at these issues. And that task force actually met earlier today, which is what led to some of the governor's comments.
So would you say, Steve, let's go back to things like the body cam use, the release of the footage, which I know you were involved with, the change of that law, and the use of body cams, some of the stuff that you laundry listed there for us. Would you say, Steve, offhand, without, you know, being a specific count, are we in, say, the top five, top 10 states in the country? Are we in the upper tier of that stuff already?
Yeah, we're definitely in the upper tier. We certainly are not leading the nation, we obviously and certainly have more work to do on these issues, but I would say we're in the top 10 or 12. There's various organizations out there, whether it be Eight That Can't Wait or Campaign Zero or some of the other police reform organizations that has consistently recognized that Connecticut has taken some of these steps and national best practices.
The local level, Steve, you and I well know, and I've talked about it a lot here. People understand this, Steve, that some of this has to come right at the city or town level, the local level where, you know, frankly, there are talks between local police departments. And a lot of that, Steve, has to do, I think, with the police unions, the union locals, and you're an attorney, you know this, and you know what goes specifically into some of this collective bargaining and union contracts. And, you know, Steve, often what's perceived by many, maybe not always true, but what is perceived as maybe an overly protective structure for officers. What do you think of that?
Yeah, and I think especially in a state like Connecticut. So back to your, first question of what are we looking to do? Certainly we will be going into special session at some point this summer. I'm fairly confident, and we'll be looking to make some additional changes and policy recommendations, and we're listening to what those are. And one of the ones that continues to come up is, we are a small state of, 3.5 million people, but we have 107 police forces, all of which have their own command structure, their own chief, their own way of doing things. And certainly policing is not uniform across the state. We do have POST, the Police Oversight Standards and Training Board, who promulgates kind of best practices for police departments across the state, but how those policies are implemented within different police departments varies greatly. And also, obviously, resources vary greatly across police departments. So the training budget in one municipality may be significantly higher than another, because that town's wealthier and has more tax revenue or chooses to devote more of it to that as opposed to education or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, that's interesting because I don't think, Steve, a lot of people think about one of the things you just brought up there was training. I mean, a lot of people, I would think, Steve, think that you mentioned the post, the standard training, but training costs money, right? And maybe one idea, Steve, would be to make that, you think, more uniform, give some of these cash-strapped, cities and towns money or resources to level that, or maybe combine some of this training with bigger cities and towns. Any of that being thought about?
I think it has to be. I think it has to be part of it. I mean, we often talk on a number of levels about, the cost of living in Connecticut, what drives some of that cost. And some of it is, a lot of it is the redundancy of local service and the fact that we have all these different departments trying to do training. Certainly the standard certification of a police officer happens at the state level. But on a day-to-day as an officer advances. Maybe they move up from sergeant to captain, and what does that mean in one municipality versus another, and what sort of training is involved, and how is it being applied, on a particular shift, or, you know, based on the instructions being given at lineup in one municipality. We know we have very small municipalities by land size. And so, you know, it's every day in the state of Connecticut, multiple times a day, that a crime occurs in one municipality and the person flees and gets away and is picked up in another municipality that may not even be the next town over, maybe four towns over. I think there's a lack of uniformity that leads to some of the disconnect here in Connecticut.
Steve, finally, what are you hearing from law enforcement people? I'm sure you've had their ear, they've had yours over the past couple of weeks. What are you hearing out and about from people, men and women, who wear uniforms?
I think we're hearing something very different than we heard even last year. I think the police accountability bill we did last year received some pushback, especially as it got towards the end of the legislative session and became even a bit of a partisan fight because of some of the lobbying efforts out there. But I'm hearing a very different tone now. I'm hearing that folks understand the need to engage in these conversations to try to get this right, that this is a self-reflection and a process that we as a nation certainly need to have, but even as a state who has led on some of these issues in the past, need to continue to engage in and continue to find solutions to.
Steve, thank you. Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Steve Staffstrom joining us for a few minutes today. Steve, take care, be good, and we'll talk down the road. Appreciate it.
Take care, Paul.
Thanks. Bye-bye. All right. And dropping by there to check that out is our own Melissa Sheketoff from Melissa in the Morning, and she joins me right now on Connecticut Today. Melissa, hi. How are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you, bud?
I feel very privileged to have someone of your stature on Connecticut Today. It's
my Lord. For all the times you come on in the morning, I feel like I owe you one or two. So
what's going on? Better. What did you see in Milford today?
So it started at like 3:30, and I thought I'll get down there a few minutes early, find a parking spot, and circled around for about 20 minutes because people were showing up clearly really early. For anyone who's never been to downtown Milford, there's like a green that stretches probably 8/10 of a mile down the downtown area, like that main road. And there were cars lined on either side. It just felt like people coming from like the train station, people coming from neighborhoods. There were people opening the windows of their shops, and there was even like a dentist office had the windows open, a law firm down there. Like everyone was just like piercing out, looking at what was going on. And there were just hundreds of people all in the green. And it was, to me, Paul, I actually was like really moved by it. I mean, I've been a big proponent of the protests as long as they haven't blocked highways. I'm not into that. But I do love that people are like speaking out. And what I think I love the most about it, and, you know, totally open for debate, I love the fact that they're going on in Connecticut because, let's face it, we're one of the whiter states out there. And to me, I think it's incredible, like in Fairfield County, especially when, you know, a lot of people do pretty well, you could kind of like bypass what happened, like, oh, it's really sad, let's move on with our lives. I have to be honest, Paul, the majority of the people down there were white. Were people who clearly were saying, look, I don't understand fully what you are going through, like to the black community, but we want to stand with you. And I thought it was very peaceful. I listened to some of it just because it got really crowded and I just don't want to get sick. So
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Kind of further back. But I listened to some of the speech and it was just kind of, you know, it was people just talking about like, let's just be open to the fact that we're different and that's totally okay. And who are we to judge each other? And I don't know. I mean, from like a Christian standpoint, I mean, I've always kind of felt that way. You know, we're human. We're all, you know, we're all imperfect. We all sin. And no matter how much money you make or no matter what job title you have or what color your skin is, literally no person has a right to judge another. So to me, I just thought it was a very, very cool movement. I was super impressed. It was controlled. Cars were very respectful. It just seemed like it all was very well maintained. I was very impressed with it. It was very moving.
What was the police presence like, Melissa?
So honestly, other than police blocking traffic and like making sure that people could cross the roads and not get hit, I didn't particularly see police in the crowds.
Okay.
But I know like this morning I had Officer DeVito on our show, who's from the PD, and he said a lot of that the police were going to be scattered, which I did see police cars kind of lining all the way almost to, like, West River Street, right near where the police station is. And I know there was a big police presence there because they had heard rumors that they were going to march from the green to the police department, just because we've seen protests ending at police departments in most major cities in Connecticut. So I think a lot of the police were ready there. But there were definitely police. I didn't see them, like, getting involved. Nothing got rowdy. So the police presence wasn't huge at the town green, but I think that's because a lot of them were at the police department kind of waiting for them to move to the department. So I think that's where they were.
All right. Well, Melissa, thank you. We appreciate the time, the first person report there. Now, what is coming up that people should listen to for tomorrow on Melissa in the Morning?
Well, dang, Paul, you woke me up from my nap.
I'm sorry.
What is on tomorrow? I'm totally kidding. No. I go to bed when Chase goes to bed. No, I'm kidding. I'm trying to think. Let's see. Tomorrow's Tuesday, right?
Yes.
You know, a quarantine brain. So Tuesday, what's on tomorrow? So tomorrow we have Jenny Curry, who is our professional counselor. She is talking about, which I think is very interesting. You know how it's part of the reason I feel like a lot of people don't talk about the issues at hand is because you don't want to step on eggshells, right? You don't want to feel like you're offending other people. But that's the struggle here, is that we're just not talking about it at all. So
as opposed to me, I love offending people. It's what I get paid for. Yes.
Sure, exactly. But like, Paul, you're the minority and I love you to death. But like, most people not only will not get on the radio and talk about it, but people in general, like, you know, you'll go to a social. I have to be honest, Paul. I've been to a few social gatherings, and I won't say with who because it doesn't matter.
Okay.
But in the past few days where people are like bashing what's been going on, and your immediate thought is to be like, I'm just going to shut up. I'm just not going to say anything because I don't want to upset anybody.
Yeah.
But I've found for like the first time in my life, I'm like, you know what? I don't agree with what you're saying.
Okay.
And I'm not going to be a part of this. Like, I don't think what you're saying is educated, and I'm going to walk away from this. And it's like the first time in my life I felt I could say that, but a lot of people don't have that strength to do it. So I feel like Jenny's going to talk a little bit about that tomorrow.
Okay.
And, of course, we're also knee-deep in a pandemic. So we've got a couple of experts coming on. We're talking to the AMR about, you know, rescue and how that all works with COVID-19.
Oh, interesting.
Going to hospitals.
Yeah.
And then, like, Nuvance Health coming on to deal with anxiety, people worrying that we're opening up the state too soon or not opening up early enough.
Okay.
So, we're knee-deep in pandemic and protest, babe.
Oh, by the way, did you see what the WHO said a few minutes ago today?
No, what happened?
You know all that thing about asymptomatic people can spread COVID?
Yeah.
Maybe not.
What do you mean, maybe not?
Well,
that's like the whole basis of this. What are you talking about? How do you tell me this on live radio right now? Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's breaking
news. Yeah, and I've talked about it a few times. They said concentrate on people that have symptoms. If nobody has a symptom, it's now pretty rare that they could spread the disease. I'll let you Google it, okay?
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I'm about to jump back on my exercise bike and Google the whole thing. I was watching Riverdale, but that sounds way more interesting. So I'm gonna
go check Melissa. Talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. See you tomorrow.
Bye, babe. All right, Melissa Sheketoff there. Melissa in the Morning, 5 to 10, right here on WICC.
100,000 tests. So we're closing in on about 9% of our total population, which probably puts us in the top 10 or so in terms of states across the country in terms of per capita testing. Of particular interest to me is, again, the positivity rate. Very important. The percentage of people who test positive out of the total is still down around 2%. If you look at what it's been historically, you know, you look at 44,000 tests, 345 positive cases out of 305 tests performed, that's about 14%. It shows you our trend is in the right direction. Total hospitalizations, that trend continues down. This is the interesting chart again, because the positivity rate is what is so important in terms of getting an idea of community spread, giving you an idea of where COVID is in the greater population. Those numbers can spike up or down a little bit depending upon nursing homes or prisons or congregate, but that trend line down towards 2% is extraordinary good news, not just for us, but for our region. And that, I talk about the region because here you can see the week-over-week change in the percentage of tests that return positive. And you can see Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, Rhode Island, New Jersey are all trending down. The number of people who test positive, the percentage of people who test positive has been going down. Unlike other parts of the country that opened up perhaps a little bit earlier, or something else is going on. That's Arizona, North Carolina, Florida, Texas. If we have a positivity rate on average of about, say, 3% over the last week, Arizona's at 12%, North Carolina's at 7%, Texas is at 7%, and Texas has the highest level of hospitalizations they've had in a couple of months. So it's just a reminder to maintain, wear the mask and maintain your discipline, because you see what's going on around the rest of the country, and we're tracking that very, very carefully. And that gets us a little bit to where we are more broadly in our environment. We just got off the teleconference with Vice President Pence and Dr. Birx. And they pointed out, again, the nature of these flare-ups in different states around the country and what that means. Obviously, we have a high percentage of our people here in the greater Northeast that wear face masks and other cloth coverings. You know, so important. Private gathering size limited to what right now it's 10, 50 people outside. As David Lane will say, that number is about to go up. But let's just wait a minute. You know, we're putting in place these protocols, but I understand there's some contradictions out there, because you've seen massive demonstrations with thousands of people out there. And we're going to wait and see what impact that has on our positivity rate going forward. And those protests, you know, remind us that we're battling two pandemics at the same time. You know, one is COVID that attacks the body, and the other is racism that attacks the soul. And it's that response to George Floyd that represents the thousands of people who have been protesting peacefully around the state of Connecticut. No arrests, as far as I know, over the last week or so. But I do worry that in a short period of time, we've gone from we're all in this together. That was our mantra as we fought COVID, to I can't breathe. And the irony is not lost on me that somebody suffering severely from COVID, you know, sometimes feels like a knee on your throat. And in both cases, you can't breathe, and you can't breathe freely. So that's the irony of when I say small groups and large groups and avoid mass gatherings. I had to think about that this weekend as I, you know, wanted to show solidarity to those people who are standing up against racism and standing up, as did our state police and our municipal police, stand up with the protesters. And yet I also wanted to, you know, make sure we stayed aware of where we are in the COVID crisis. So I went to a small outdoor church service in Bridgeport with about 100 people in their cars. You know, a religious service handled appropriately. And talked about racism and how it impacts all of our different communities. I was sort of interested that at our meetings with Vice President Pence, everybody's talking about the impact of these demonstrations in their different states. You know, Andrew Cuomo from New York's told everybody, and they've got thousands and thousands of people, cheek and jowl, protesting. He wants everybody to go get tested. Dr. Birx had some simpler advice to the protesters. Don't go visit your grandparents for 2 weeks. Stay away from those most vulnerable populations. I'd just like to say, in terms of where we're going forward on this next slide, this is our guidelines for, they say here, phase two. But I noticed that in New York, our neighbor, we often look to our neighbors to see where we are in the reopening cycle. They've just started what they call phase one. And in New York, phase one is opening manufacturing, opening for outdoor construction, letting a retail business be available for pickup only. Well, as you know, Connecticut never stopped any of those things. So if that was, if that's phase one, then what we did on May 20th, where you opened up for outdoor eating and you know, later on hair and nail hair salons and the such, that was our phase two. So in many ways, what we're gonna be doing on June 17th in about 8 days is our phase three. And as David can explain, we're opening up in effect about 95% of our economy. Very quickly, as you can see on this chart, lodging. You remember hotels, we said only for first responders. We didn't want a lot of back and forth traffic between New York and Connecticut and Massachusetts. But now we all have more or less the same low positivity rate. We think this is a calculated risk and help our tourism industry get going. Sports, gyms, pools, you understand what that means in terms of back to a new normalcy. Outdoor amusement parks. Some of these are large amusement parks. And David Layman has been invaluable working with all the folks in these different trade associations, coming up with the protocols to make sure their employees are safe and give the customers confidence they can get back. You know, personal services, this is the rest of the personal services, everything from nails to tattoos, indoor recreation, including bowling, major outdoor events, we're opening those up a little bit as well. David can explain what some of the parameters are there. We tend not to limit the number of people. We do tend to think in terms of capacity and limiting the number of people who can park, just to make it easier to maintain that spacing, just as Katie Dykes has been doing at our beaches and parks over the last few months. Finally, I think the outdoor dining has worked pretty well. And if you've had a chance to go eat outdoors, I know I was really looking forward to it. You know, everybody is maintaining the protocol seriously. We had very few complaints. So I think we're ready to go with the indoor dining, which will be also on June 17th. And then finally, libraries. So this gives you just a little bit of an idea of how we're getting back to our new normal. 95% of our economy is open. But that is all subject to, let's see what happened over the last week or so, given the protests. Memorial Day, we seem to have weathered that in terms of not a big uptick. And time will tell. So far, so good. David, anything you'd like to add, or should we just take some questions?
No, Governor, I think you said it well. As you mentioned, this really is the big phase of our reopening. There is a considerable amount of businesses that are going to be open. There is a third phase in mid-July that we're also anticipating. But after June 17th, the vast majority of our economy will be up and operating.
Three Eyewitness News.
Yes, Governor, just wanted to ask, you know, as we look forward to phase two of the reopening, where do we stand on the testing? I know that you mentioned that we've done around 300,000 tests so far. Are we meeting that 100,000 per week metric?
Why don't I let Josh Jabal, our testing czar, answer that question?
Thanks, Governor, and thanks for the question. So we have successfully scaled up our laboratory testing capacity to well over 100,000 at this point. And, you know, as the governor mentioned, we're in the top 10 states in the country per capita in terms of the testing that we're doing. And our positivity rate, as he said, is low and continuing to trend down. You know, we are reevaluating how we deploy some of those tests based on some changes in CDC guidelines. And we're also struggling with some vague and often contradictory advice from the federal government in terms of what's going to be reimbursed for testing. So we're taking some time to really ensure that we're deploying all those tests in the way that delivers both the greatest public health benefit, you know, as well as financial sustainability for our testing program, knowing that we're going to be at this for quite some time. So we're going to keep pushing forward hard with areas that we know are critical: nursing home testing, prisons, testing in our densely populated urban communities that have been hit so hard. But in some other areas, we may be dialing back a little bit where we don't see as much public health benefit. But we've got the capacity created that we need to ensure we can meet the public health challenges.
News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, I wanted to ask you two things. One about the independent analysis for the nursing homes and assisted living. It seems like, you know, sometimes you need to take a step back and go over things in order to make the step forward. So do you kind of see it as that, to understand preparation and all that stuff so you know what to do moving forward? And the second question would be with respect to weddings and kind of where all that stands right now.
Well, first of all, in the nursing homes, obviously that was the tragic center for our state and the other 49 states in terms of fatalities. And if there's a chance that there could be a second surge later on this summer, more likely in the fall, we want to be ready. And so we have a strong outside group that focuses here in terms of infection protocols, PPE, and more long-term what our nursing homes are going to look like. So I thought that was an investment worth making so we can learn going forward and to be able to share those notes with our fellow governors in the region, because they're doing much the same type of analysis. You know, weddings, as you know, we've got graduations up to 150 people outside. You say, hey, I can do graduations. How about weddings? You know, our thinking right now is that we want to be a little more cautious with weddings. You're eating wedding cake. You're not wearing a mask. There's maybe beverages involved. There could be dancing. So it's a much more social, less inclined towards social distancing than, say, an outdoor church service. But that said, we're going to be taking a look at that over the course of the next 2 weeks.
Governor, if I could just jump in there quickly. I was on with the event industry this afternoon going through this. And as you mentioned, in phase two, 50-person outdoor events, including weddings, will be allowed. And then in phase three in mid-July, we anticipate that number going to 100. But that is something we need to give a further look to, not just outdoors, but indoors, giving some sense of what type of capacity, perhaps with a cap, can be done, whether it's in July or beyond indoors. So we're actively having dialogue with the industry there, and we're going to try to provide as much clarity as we can.
News 12 Connecticut. Fox 61.
Hello, two questions this afternoon. First of all, for the governor or the commissioner, we saw the date for the reopening, the phase two coming, moved up a little bit to June 17th, but we only just got guidelines over this past weekend for what businesses need to do to have that certification to reopen. Do you think that's enough time for businesses to address everything that they need to do in order to get back to business?
Go for it, David.
Sure. It's a great question. I do is the short answer for really a couple of reasons. One of the concerns we heard in phase one was the availability of PPE and disinfectant cleaning supplies as well. And we've really seen that market loosen up. There is a lot of availability. It's easier to find, and there's less lead time that's needed. So that was a concern before, but I think it's less of a concern right now. And secondly, a lot of the guidelines that we put forth as it relates to hygiene, mask wearing, up to 50% capacity, you know, that's consistent in many ways with what we did in phase one. So I think a lot of businesses saw the phase one guidelines and anticipated something very similar, which is what we delivered over the weekend. So businesses are eager to get back to business here on the 17th of June, and I think they're ready.
And the second question for the governor, you know, we've heard a lot with the protests over the weekend and even last week that there were calls to either defund or disband police departments right here in Connecticut. What's your stance on these calls, and should any Connecticut police departments be defunded in your view?
No, I don't think we should be defunding. But what I think many of the protesters mean, and I think rightfully so, is that we consider a police response the answer to a broader and broader variety of societal ills. And in many cases, you may find that it's a social worker. You may find that it's a mental health expert. You may find that it's an addiction expert. And we're asking our police to solve all these, where in fact, I think we need other folks who can get involved in the community to make a difference. That's why our community liaison is going to be a bigger piece of our portfolio going forward.
Thank you.
NBC Connecticut.
Regarding George Floyd and the protests around the state and the country, Governor Cuomo called back the legislature in New York this week, looking to pass several bills banning chokeholds, prohibiting false race-based 911 reports. Governor, are you planning on doing anything similar?
We're planning to do something similar. Paul's in conversations with the legislative leadership, coming up with a program that a legislative agenda that makes a lot of sense, and criminal justice reform and police accountability will be at the top of that list.
Is there a timeline on that, and would you be looking to ban chokeholds in the state?
Yes is the answer to the second question. What's the first question, Paul?
In terms of timeline, we'll be setting the timeline once we are in full agreement with the governor, with the legislative leaders on the actual bill. But we are working in earnest, working with the Legislative Committee of Cognizance as well as legislative leaders. So we'll have more details on when the governor will officially call them back into session, but that is the governor's intent.
And then for Josh, regarding contact tracing, where do you think stand there? Is it in line for the phase two reopening? And then for the nursing home report, could there be any disciplinary actions coming out of that?
So on the second question first, unlikely. I mean, I think this is an opportunity to learn, right, what we can do, what we did right, what we can do better, preparing both for a second wave and looking longer term. With regards to contact tracing, the team continues to make great progress, bringing on local health departments, bringing on more volunteers, continuing to ramp up. We hope to have our first snapshot of the metrics around that by midweek, recognizing that some local health departments are going to stick with their local processes in the short term, so we need to be able to consolidate all that data to see all of the contact tracing that's going on across the state at this point in time.
Thank you.
WTIC 1080 News.
Hi, Mr. Governor. Having listened in on the police task force earlier, I know you were on there for a while. Some of the recommendations the task force has are getting from anything from getting officers to listen more and listen better to de-escalating situations, all the way to eliminating police chases in cases of there's an equipment problem or something, you know, dented fender, something like that. What are some of the top things that come to mind for you that you'd like to see the task force suggest?
Well, thank you for that question. First of all, the legislature made a great, important down payment, I think, on police accountability, really limited use of force, put in place clear escalation procedures, talked about chokeholds, talked about the fact that video cams should be more prevalent. Video cams have to have the video released within 4 days. These are some of the programs that they put in place last year, and along with that was the Police Accountability Task Force. That Police Accountability Task Force, as you pointed out, I met with via Zoom today, just to see we have not done enough. What else can we do in terms of confidence building so that people have confidence that their municipal and state police are there protecting them? And just as importantly, how we can make sure that there are clear guidelines for our police. We talked about a broader, required use of video cams, required use of body cams, making sure that that is available to everybody, that they use those. Perhaps we monitor those on a more regular basis. We spent a fair amount of time talking about, and I know James Ravella over at the state police is already planning to roll this out, again, community liaisons, so that each and every one of our troops has a close relationship with the community leaders spread across, you know, different segments of the community. So when things come up, we're ready, we're in communication, we can work together. And finally, I've been thinking about what are the rules of the road for bystanders? In particular, those cops who are standing by. You saw what happened with George Floyd. I saw some police just standing by, not getting involved. What should be the consequences for them? That, more broadly, training will be some of the different programs and ideas and recommendations that come out of the task force. And I think you're going to see another bill, as we talked about before, coming through the legislature, informed by that task force.
Highway protests last weekend, a couple times, with the 95 shut down around West Haven. Is there anything else state police can do about that, or is that just something that to be expected at this point?
No, we've mitigated that a lot, I got to tell you. And we've done that in part because our public safety officers are meeting with the community leaders and the protest leaders and saying, look, we may share some of the same goals in terms of what we're protesting about, but you've got to do it safely. So I think we are managing through that. Time will tell.